Welcome to all of you. If you have not yet been in our court, we're happy to have you here today. We have one case on our 2 o'clock docket. Beck and Dan versus State of Texas. If the clerk will please announce counsel, who will be arguing today. Thank you. All right, Mr. Francis.
Thank you, Judge.
With the court's indulgence, I would like to just point out two minor points in my brief that I caught that were typos. I'd consider typos, if that's all right. On page 7 at the bottom, I make the statement that the expert witness said that the metabolite was a controlled substance. That's not correct. She said cocaine was. Page 10, Leon Morris, the psychologist who was testifying, I put in here that in 2008 she used cocaine on a daily basis. Well, obviously the alleged offense occurred in 2008. That's not exactly correct. More specifically, he said that when he saw her in 2008, she had begun using cocaine on a daily basis, and that was August of 2008, well after the date of the offense. I just wanted to clarify that, not create the impression that basically that evidence was there that she in fact had committed an offense. Miss Beckenden was convicted of a felony DWI, and the substance at issue was cocaine. And the only evidence of cocaine came from the testimony of Renee Hawkins, a DPS toxicologist. The complaint we have essentially is this, that Ms. Hawkins admittedly violated the standards and practices and protocols for the use of the instrument that she used to test the substance with, that is the blood of my client. That in fact, she said that she saw traces of cocaine, but she even went so far as to say that it was below the reportable cutoff, and she was not even allowed to say she saw them. But by the way, jury, I saw them, and here's what it means to me, and I have an opinion based on what I saw. There was a gatekeeper hearing, and at that gatekeeper hearing, the reliability and relevance was at issue. And the court found that, in fact, the testimony, which included the statements about the talking about things below the reportable cutoff amount, were reliable and relevant, even though there'd been no evidence about deviating from the protocol as being a scientific methodology that was reliable. She talked generally about the gas instrument, but not about what she did in ignoring the protocols of the DPS lab.
Does it really matter, Mr. Francis, in this case, since it's not a quantifiable amount required to substantiate this offense? It's just some amount.
Well, I think it does matter because without her testimony about that, the only thing that we're talking about that the instrument found was metabolite. It's metabolite. An inactive metabolite that does not affect the central nervous system, it would have no effect, could not impair her at all. And given the half-life of that metabolite, the time that she had introduced cocaine into her body could have been several days earlier. And it could have worn off long before the driving incident. And if you just stick with that, then what you're left with is some speculation about when she may have done that, may have ingested cocaine. But there's no direct evidence that she had any in her system at the time. She's got that moving window that you got to hit, that window when they're operating a motor vehicle. And they broadened the window so much that it wasn't just the time she was operating the vehicle. It could have been days earlier.
What you're talking about really a question of retrograde extrapolation from what she said she saw, going back to try to connect it with what she thinks that the defendant had in her system at the time she was driving?
Well, I'm not sure if I'd call it that. I mean, you may be correct. It's basically simply saying, well, the instrument has its limits. Everything has its limits. And I'm not supposed to even talk about what is below a certain level. But I'm going to violate that protocol, and I'm going to say I saw a trace of cocaine. Since I saw a trace of cocaine, I know that because of the half-life of cocaine, that she had at least some amount of cocaine in her system when she was driving. Therefore, my expert opinion is, yes, she had cocaine in her system. That's the problem, that she did nothing to explain how that could be scientifically valid. Now, maybe it is. I don't know. But it's the state's burden to show by clear and convincing evidence that it's reliable. And what she did instead was say, well, I'm not supposed to even say I saw this under our protocols, but I'm going to say that I saw it anyway.
So once she got out of the area that she was allowed to testify based on the protocol,
yes,
of the DPS, it was her personal opinion, a speculative opinion?
Yes, it was, because you have to show by clear and convincing evidence a host of factors and things to show that it's a valid scientific methodology. And she didn't even make any attempt to do that. I mean, she talked about how the instrument worked, but then she says, oh, by the way, yes, I did see something that's below what I'm allowed to talk about, below the reportable cutoff, and then she went ahead and talked about it. I mean, that's really kind of what's so shocking to me, is that she just flat admitted right up front that under DPS protocols, I can't even acknowledge it. I can't say that I saw it.
How do you reconcile that with the Summers case that was handed down about a week and a half ago, wherein they talk about the fact that the amount was below the DPS reportable limit?
Well, two different things there. First of all, that was talking about the EMIT test. EMIT test is whether it had scientific reliability separate and apart from the gas instrument. I'll just call it the gas instrument. I'm not going to try to pronounce that one either. What they did in that case, they had three different expert witnesses. Interestingly enough, one of them was apparently the same expert as in this case, who testified extensively about the validity of using the EMIT test even without getting into the gas instrument. They showed that that test has been used as a standalone test in lots of instances, that it has scientific reliability, and they use that to justify a departure from the protocol. The protocol being, you don't talk about this test until you do the backup test. That is the gas test. And that's what you use as the gas test. It's a confirmatory test. I'm not saying that she could not possibly have justified what she did. I'm just saying that as an expert testifying to scientific reliability, she had the obligation and the burden to do that, to justify to the trial court through her testimony and to show all the various factors that you have to go through. And she didn't do that, made no attempt to do that. She just said, I'm not going to pay attention to this protocol. As a matter of law, the trial judge should not have allowed that to be heard by the jury. So it's a different situation than the case you're talking about.
It's different, but the Court of Criminal Appeals didn't seem to have any problem with the idea that this deviated from the DPS.
Well, but the reason they didn't is because of the extensive evidence they had. That other courts, other cases have used the EMIT test extensively as a standalone test. And you have three different expert witnesses who said the same thing. You had many other cases where that's been used. Compare that to this case, where there's absolutely nothing that says it's okay to deviate from this protocol. It's okay to go below the reportable cutoff. I don't know what the protocol is there for. I mean, I really don't. But it's up to them to explain what it's there for and to show that if you ignore it, you're still going to have scientifically valid results. And
I'd ask you to reflect on the language that's in the record on page 48, where the questioning dealt with the test that was performed in May of 2008.
I'm sorry, let me find it if I could very quickly.
I don't know if you have the transcript there. The
yes, I do. Let me find that page.
On page 48, that was talking about the test performed in May of 2008, which was the EMIT test.
Yes, that's correct.
to tell the jury what you screened for in May of 2008. We tested for several classes of drugs. We tested for six classes: ketamines, barbiturates, benzoylecticamine, cocaine and its metabolites, opiates, and phenacetamidine, which is PCP. And what was the result of that 2008? The results indicated a positive response in the cocaine and the cocaine metabolites class. Now, that's talking about the email test.
Yes, sir.
And the Court of Criminal Appeals just told us that the conclusion in the Summers case, and it's on the very final conclusion page. The function of the reliability inquiry in Kelly against State is to assist trial courts in weeding out so-called junk science. The record contains sufficient evidence showing that email, with or without a confirmation test, is reliable scientific evidence. We conclude that the reliability of even a single unconfirmed EMIT test has been sufficiently established that it meets the first two Kelly prongs. And we hold that the Court of Appeals erred. In this case, they were excluding the evidence in the Waco court case, Summers case. And here, the issue is not excluding, but admitting. It's what the trial court did. And the objection in the trial court is on relevancy and reliability. And then this court, in this very same case, and talking about relevancy, makes the comment that because in the Summers case, the trial court said that the EMIT test was irrelevant. And then the Court of Criminal Appeals reminds us again that evidence need not by itself prove or disprove a particular fact to be relevant. It is sufficient if the evidence provides a small nudge towards proving or disproving some fact of consequence. And here, the fact of consequence, according to the indictment, was that Ms. Beckendon had ingested a dangerous drug or a prohibited drug prior to driving his vehicle on the occasion in question in February of 2009. Now, I don't see how those, when you say there's no evidence, and when the Supreme Court, Court of Criminal Appeals telling us, and we're bound to follow their precedent, that EMIT is a good standalone test. And then the evidence is direct here on page 48 of the record without objection, that well, there's an objection as to relevance, that test should not have been admitted, and the direct result is that it confirmed the presence of cocaine and or its metabolites in the drug. Now, how is that not direct evidence that, and that we're bound to follow precedent in the Court of Criminal Appeals in addressing this case?
Well, Your Honor, in the Summers case, I believe, and I don't have the exact page notated, but I did notice that what the Court of Criminal Appeals said that is that the EMIT test will only detect the metabolites, not the actual cocaine. And frankly, I believe it's the same Renee Hawkins who testified to that in that Court of Criminal Appeals case. And if you listen, if you look at what she says here on page 48, it's talking about a class. That is, they detect a certain class of drugs, but you don't know what it is until you go run the gas test. It's much more better test than the other test. So what we're talking about is metabolites, that they detected metabolites. So it shows that at some point in the past, this person has ingested cocaine.
Along the written report, that states Exhibit 24, the conclusion of that report, and stating the results of analysis interpretation, it says blood drugs, benzoylecticamine, a cocaine metabolite, 1.4 milligrams per liter.
Yes, Your Honor, that's what cocaine breaks down into, so that's what it detected.
All of us what is it that gets to your argument that with this kind of direct evidence, that there wasn't evidence that she was driving in an intoxicated state as a consequence of the ingestion of cocaine in the first place?
Well, what I'm saying is the only evidence of cocaine in her system came from the Renee Hawkins testimony about the trace element. She admits in her testimony, but she says, if I didn't see that trace element and to rely on it, I could not testify that she had cocaine in her system when she was operating that vehicle. All I can say is that at some point on this broad window of time, she had ingested some in her system, but not as of the moment she was operating the motor vehicle.
We'll give you an additional 3 minutes, and if you'll do so for the other side, please. I know we've got some more questions, so.
I have a question. Is the Texas Department of Public Safety report, Safe Exhibit 24, is that based on the gas test or is that based on the EMIT test?
That's the gas test.
Okay. So we're not really saying, even in this case, it doesn't even really involve the EMIT test. Your objection is that she's saying based on the gas test, she saw a trace amount of cocaine, and based on the gas test, it's under the reportable limit of the gas test.
That's correct. That's the essence of our argument.
But that's just not what I just read to you about the EMIT test. This exhibit 24 says that it's a blood analysis on an enzymatic method, EMIT, that identifies six classes. And then this language I just read to you, the testimony that the EMIT test resulted in a positive response for cocaine and cocaine metabolite class. That's on page 48, at line 19.
Yes, Your Honor, I realize that, but if you go further, the question is, so shortly after the time you received the blood sample, you did the screening, and the screening indicated the presence of cocaine and or its metabolites. Answer correct. She's not saying cocaine was necessarily found. And when you look at what the Court of Criminal Appeals has said in that case, where, as I recall, she was the one who testified, and it kind of shocked me when I read it, that this EMIT test can't even detect cocaine. It's the metabolite only, or as they put it, the cocaine / metabolite class of drugs. It just says, okay, is there something here we need to investigate further? Do we have a positive for this one, or just this one? And the one that's your positive one on the EMIT test, then you run the gas test on it.
But State's Exhibit 24 is not referring only to the gas test. It's referring to the EMIT test as well, and giving results based on the EMIT test as well, is it not? Because that's what it says in the... When I'm reading it, an enzymatic method, EMET, was used to screen for six classes of drugs. The EMET detection cut off. So it's not just referring to the gas.
Well, it's saying that we did that as a preliminary test. But then we ran the next test, the GCMS or LCMS, and I believe the testimony was they used the GCMS, the gas test. And then this was the result, the metabolite, 1.4 milligrams per liter. So that is reporting the results of the gas test. They're simply saying that to start out with, we tested for all these other things too, the different classes of drugs. And then apparently it was a positive for this particular class, so they ran the gas test, which as I understand is a more expensive test, and they're not going to run that until they have the EMIT positive that says, okay, you got something here. You better check into this. You better run the gas test and see what's really here.
So the metabolite was at a measurable, reportable quantity.
Yes.
And this report doesn't say anything about trace amounts of cocaine.
That's correct. Not a single thing. It was the verbal statements of the expert witness at the gatekeeper hearing that first brought this up, where she suddenly said, well, by the way, I saw a trace, although it's below the reportable amount, and I can't even say I saw it, but by the way, oh yes, I did see it. And because I saw it, I can form an opinion that she did have cocaine in her system at the time she was driving. Not just that it's possible, but it's also possible it could have been some other time, some earlier time, but it's something I can with assurance say because I'm relying on that trace that I saw. That's the essence of what she did, but she didn't go further and put on any evidence to show that was scientifically proper to do that. Now, like I say, maybe it is. I don't know. But it's up to the state to prove this up and up to the trial judge to make sure everything's reliable and relevant before it's allowed to see the light of day in front of the jury.
So the EMIT test confirms the presence of the metabolite for cocaine as well as the presence of these other drugs, and it's a screening test.
That's correct.
And
whatever's there of those classes.
It tests positive. And then the gas test is used to identify the exact precise quantity of each substance in the blood. Is that correct?
That's correct. The substance, it can detect and show a metabolite, or it can show cocaine. It can show various other listed items. The gas test can.
But the gas test is used to measure the quantity, and the EMIT test is used to just confirm the presence of something.
Of a class.
Okay.
Of a class. Or in this case, as I pointed out, and I thought I'd written down the page number in that new case, that from that testimony in the other case that talks about judicial notice of these things, the EMIT test does not even test for cocaine. It tests for metabolites. Which, once again, is this, you know, it's you're throwing a bunch of stuff on the wall and saying, I've got a huge window of time here. I can use the EMIT test to say, did somebody ingest cocaine at some point back days ago or even more recently? And that's why it's used in parole violation cases, probation violation cases, when it doesn't matter exactly when you took the cocaine. The fact is, you're not supposed to be taking it. Not relevant, and plus the fact is that metabolites only come from cocaine. Cocaine breaks down into metabolites. So if you find a metabolite, which is an inactive substance, it's not going to affect the central nervous system. If you do that, then you can say with assurance that at some point in the past, some indeterminate time, within a certain range, that yes, this person ingested cocaine. But the cocaine half-life is a lot shorter, than the half-life of the metabolite. So therefore, all you can really tell with the EMIT test is, okay, yes, we tested your blood, and it shows that at some point within X number of days or whatever length of time, that yes, you did ingest cocaine. Therefore, you know, we're going to bust your probation or bust your parole.
And isn't there evidence in this case as well from Ms. Hawkins that the amount of metabolites can vary from person to person depending on a variety of factors, including prior drug use and habitual drug use?
Yes, that's what I recall is habitual drug use, that it can. It can stay in the system longer. I don't recall any specific. In fact, I think that she was asked several times, what's the half-life of a metabolite? And I can't recall that she ever gave an actual direct answer. She talked about it, but I just know from what I've seen that it's substantially longer than cocaine. Cocaine's half-life is between 30 and 90 minutes, average 60 minutes. And we're talking about, I think at one point she said that metabolite could build up in the system of a habitual user for 36 hours of buildup. That doesn't mean it's going to all be gone, because at that point, if it starts coming down, you're still going to be able to detect it. You have to go through several half-lives before it totally disappears. So you're talking about, you know, multiple days. I don't know, maybe a week, maybe two. I can't say with assurance, but it's a long period of time that it can be detected.
Could you put this in context or explain? In your brief, you say that on page 5 of the record, pages 50 and 54, she...
I'm sorry, Your Honor, is it page 5 of my brief?
It's page 9 of your brief.
9,
top
okay.
Page, the first complete sentence. She cannot say as a forensic scientist whether or not by looking at a level of metabolized cocaine blood that someone was impaired. And then the 1.4 level of benzoylcholine, is one of the larger amounts and is consistent with 14 lines of cocaine. Does she ever explain? I mean, what's the context of this? Because it seems contradictory to me.
Well, I understand. I had a hard time at sometimes following what she was saying as she was testifying to as to exactly. And I was, at this point, on this particular page of my brief, I was going through the, I think this was fact statement, just kind of going through what the testimony had been.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact is that she has said that if you look at the metabolite alone, and that's all you saw, the 1.4, she has testified, she couldn't say that Ms. Beckenham was impaired or had cocaine in her system when she was driving the vehicle. She said it would show that at some point she had had a large amount of cocaine, like a consistent with binge usage of cocaine. But none of that ever dealt with proving up that there was cocaine in her system when she was operating the vehicle. The only thing that did that was this trace amount business. If I saw a trace amount, I can now rely on that to form an opinion. And once again, to get to that stage, there has to be a scientific reliability showing. Scientific methodology has to be accurate, and it has to be valid, and you have to go through a lot of different factors that y'all are totally familiar with. I've got them listed here, but no point in going through that. But all the factors you have to go through to try to show that the scientific evidence is valid and it's based on good science.
So what is the evidence of the amount of cocaine in that specific person's body necessary to cause a loss of normal use of the mental or physical faculties? Is there any testimony about the amount?
She testified that any amount could do it. It's a central nervous system stimulant to get people to be
aggressive. Well, I understand
aggressive.
Could do it, but don't we have to look at the individual and the way and what they tried to eat and drink and to determine whether that person lost the normal use of the mental physical faculties as a result of the cocaine? Or do we not? Do we just have a zero tolerance?
As I read it, I think it's zero tolerance. I hate to admit it since I'm representing the defendant, mm-hmm. but I think that is the case, that when you get into alcohol, you can look at that and look at the amounts and so forth. But at least as far as Ms. Hawkins' testimony is concerned, and I haven't gone back and tried to see if you know, I agree or disagree, because it doesn't matter at this point. It's an appeal. It's too late to do that. If that's the case or not. So she says any amount is enough, which means any amount of cocaine in the system would be enough to possibly or to impair the driver. I mean, that's what she says.
Okay, and proof beyond reasonable doubt, I'm just trying to figure out where we are here, is possible to impair proof beyond reasonable doubt, or does it require testimony that it does and did impair that person, or always impairs everybody, or is possible enough to meet the standard for proof beyond reasonable doubt?
Well, frankly, I did not brief that angle on it, but I think that based on what Ms. Hawkins was testifying about, I think it's going to be up to the jury to decide at that point. Once they have been given testimony that says, yes, there was cocaine in this person's system, like any other jury, they can find guilty, not guilty. I mean, certainly there was a wreck. People were injured. Thankfully, I think all of them recovered from that. But there can be lots of reasons why people have wrecks. It can be emotional upset with their spouse. It can be texting. It can be talking on the phone. But that doesn't make it a DWI. And so they do have to show something in that person's system at the time they were driving in order to do that. And the metabolite's not going to be enough. She said that. It's not. But the metabolite here is inactive metabolite. It does not affect the central nervous system. So that's not a problem. But I think the answer to your question, without continuing to go too far afield, I'm sorry, I apologize. Now, I don't think that there has to be a quantitative amount aside from, I think it needs to show up on the gas test in an amount high enough to be reportable. Now, I don't know if, you know, once again, there's been no explanation as to why that there is a particular cutoff. I mean, if the gas instrument is so sensitive, then why is it at that one half of 0.05? Why is it that other drugs are 0.10, half of that? I don't know.
Could be the error level. that they could have picked that level because that's the error.
Yes, once again, that's possible, but here again, I don't know. And the problem is, since the person who's pushing to have this expert testimony admitted to the jury, they have this responsibility to prove all this up. And an absence of that in the record does not mean that it's okay. I mean, we have to certainly raise the error by bringing it here to the Court of Appeals and having the record, having the reporter's record typed up from the hearing. But as far as the burden of proof, it's entirely, in this case, on the state. And the person who has to have to look at this and decide whether to admit it or not is going to be the trial judge. And there are just cases and cases and cases that talk about how the judge is not just a passive participant, that he basically runs the show at the hearing, and he can do lots of things. He can request materials. He can request additional testimony. I mean, he needs to be satisfied that, in fact, this is real science, not junk science, before it gets to the jury.
All right, if we can go, Justice Meyer, do you have any additional questions?
No, I'll wait and talk with the prosecutor. Okay.
Any other questions? All right, thank you, Mr. Thank you. Mr. Gillespie, and we will give you an additional, let's do 8 minutes. Try to be as even as we can.
I appreciate that. May it please the court. I want to start off answering Justice Dauphineau's question because I think it goes to a very salient issue before the court today. The expert did not testify that a trace amount of cocaine does cause impairment. She testified that whether you're talking about metabolite or a trace amount, that all she can do is relay her results and that you have to combine that with other factors to show the impaired judgment. And the site in the record for that would be volume 5 starting at page 49. She says, since cocaine is a stimulant, it will affect your judgment, which may include high-risk behavior, aggressive driving, may cause you to have dizziness and inattention. She talks about the studies for that. Then the prosecutor, I ask her, so you can't say as a forensic scientist whether or not by looking at a level of metabolite or cocaine whether someone was impaired. That's something that a jury has to look at all the facts related to driving themselves to make that determination, and she says right to that. So you've got to look at the other facts. The facts that we had in this case were the evidence that she's in this parking lot of the steakhouse, striking parked cars, jumping the curb immediately before the wreck, that she gets on this access road and blows through a red light at a major intersection at rush hour, T-boning the minivan that had the mom and the 2-year-old in it. One of the witnesses to the scene testified without objection that, quote, she'd have to be high or drunk to run that light at that time. So that's the evidence that's there before the jury. The other thing that I want to point out, and when we talk about metabolite, her testimony shows just because cocaine metabolizes incredibly rapidly, there's an hour and a half between the time of the wreck and the time of the blood draw. Then it continues to break down and metabolize after the blood is drawn. So we could have tried the case purely based on metabolite and let the jury make the inference within metabolite plus the erratic driving, the impaired judgment. And there'd be plenty for them to make that determination that they were impaired. Just because there's metabolite in the system, that doesn't mean that she wasn't under the influence of cocaine at the time of driving. The testimony was that the metabolite in her system was the equivalent of a binge amount of cocaine, 14 lines of cocaine. So you have this tremendous amount of metabolite that could have been active cocaine at the time of driving. So you've got to look at the facts of the time of driving to say, okay, do these facts... are they consistent with what the toxicologist says the reports show that someone under the influence of cocaine, what they exhibit, impaired judgment, all of these other factors, and they were certainly consistent with all of that driving time. So we don't just have somebody running a yellow. We have blowing through a red light at a major intersection at rush hour, and we have significantly impaired driving beforehand. So I think that that's an important question. I think that also goes to Justice Livingston's question about the quantifiable amount. The trace amount is not important because it can be quantified, and we can say, well, she has a trace amount in her system, therefore she had this trace amount. We know there's a bright line like 0.08 in DWI cases that she's clearly impaired. The trace amount that the scientifically reliable instrument demonstrates shows that she had some cocaine.
You mean the gas test?
Yes, the gas chromatograph test. Yes, ma'am. So by the gas test, what that revealed, it shows that she had non-metabolized cocaine in her blood at the time of the draw, at least some that had not broken down in the blood vial before the gas chromatograph testing,
Why can't she put that in her report then? If it's below 0.05, she's not allowed to put that in her report. So why if it's below 0.05, and she says that that's the, she can't put it in a report because that's the lowest calibration level of the gas test, then how come she's allowed to testify about it?
I guess a couple of things. That brings me to my first point, which is the reliability objection made at the trial court, the relevance objection made before the trial court, it does not comport to the relevance objection that, the reliability objection that they're advancing today. We as the proponent of scientific evidence clearly have the burden of showing by clear and convincing evidence that it's reliable. I submit we satisfied that burden by showing that the scientific testing, the gas chromatograph mass spectrometer testing, and you can look at the record for those sites, but she testified that the data generated by that instrument is used all across the state of Texas and all across the United States and admitted into courts and relied upon by experts. The methodology for the testing we established at both the gatekeeper hearing and in front of the jury. What she's saying and what she says in front of the, she mentions it in the gatekeeper and then there's a sentence or two, I think, inelegant wording of hers in front of the jury when she gets into, I can't even say that I saw it. What that goes to are DPS protocols and why they're in place. Now, I like to think of the courts that have looked at this have said that if you're making a challenge to scientific evidence, you have three grounds that you can challenge it: qualifications, reliability, or relevance. The Shaw Court says that out of Houston, they make the point that those are distinct grounds, and a challenge to relevance does not equal a challenge to reliability. Now, I think if you think of it like a Venn diagram, you have the circle of relevance, the circle of reliability, there's going to be some overlap. For something to be relevant, you have to establish, have a threshold showing of reliability, and I think that's the burden that we bear as the proponent of scientific evidence in a case. But I think we establish that when we establish that this instrument that generated the data is reliable, that it's accepted all across the United States, that she's qualified as a DPS toxicologist based on her chemistry degree from the University of Texas to testify to that.
You're saying that the DPS protocol has no relationship whatsoever with a reliability determination.
What I'm saying, Justice Walker, is that I think we meet our threshold showing of reliability. So when that comes in, it's incumbent upon the defense counsel at the gatekeeper hearing and or before the jury to say, I'm over here at this hyper-specific reliability question as to why these DPS protocols are in place and what's the burden of that. If you look at the record, I have the site, it's volume 5, 39 through 40. When she makes that statement, according to protocols, I can't even say that I saw it. If you look there, there's no objection. There's no motion to strike. He doesn't ask for a hearing outside the presence of the jury. He doesn't ask a single question on cross-examination as to why the protocols exist. He doesn't ask that at the gatekeeper hearing either.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Hadn't the trial court already ruled on all that at the gatekeeper
hearing? Well, I think if a fair reading of the gatekeeper testimony shows that he's advancing a relevance objection there. He cites Layton versus State, which is a relevance case. It has to do with extrapolation issue when a driver had said that he had Xanax and Valium in his system. They provide no expert testimony in Layton as to that, and the court says, well, that's not relevant to offer that. So the case he cites to the court is a relevance case. He makes a relevance objection, and then at trial, he continues to object to relevance. Every single objection that defense counsel makes is to relevance.
Didn't he object to her opinion that finding the metabolite and the trace amount of cocaine somehow or another translated into she had, or could, I think her words were, could have had a significant amount of cocaine in her system when the wreck occurred? If he objected to that as relevant, why would that be relevant? How did you meet your burden of clear and convincing evidence that that opinion is relevant?
There's a couple of things I'd say to that, Justice Gabriel. First off, I believe that that initial showing, we're not talking about something that she saw, we're talking about the data that gas chromatograph mass spectrometer generated. That's where she saw the trace amount. She testifies that it generates a fingerprint, and she can look on there, and that's where she saw the trace amounts. So I contend that we made our reliability threshold showing when we established the reliability of the instrument that generated the data and her training and her expertise in performing the testing. Secondly, I think the Summers case that you mentioned is important because in Summers, I think it's informative because the court looks to cocaine metabolite under the reportable amounts as some evidence, and they use that word, Court of Criminal Appeals uses the word of evidence, as some evidence to show that the MIT pre-screen was not unreliable. And so the Court of Criminal Appeals recognizes that the data still exists. It doesn't cease to exist because it's underneath the DPS protocols. But my point is that if he had advanced a reliability objection, then that would have put the parties at the state on notice and the court on notice about the DPS protocols, and we could have developed that testimony for y'all. In the Gillenwaters case, the Court of Criminal Appeals said that there are three reasons that comportment is so important. First off, it ensures the trial court will have an opportunity to prevent or correct errors, thereby eliminating the need for a costly and time-consuming appeal and retrial. Here, it's an abuse of discretion standard, and I don't think it's fair to Judge Rotherton to say he abused his discretion when defense counsel, after we meet the threshold reliability showing, he never says, well, wait a second, I have a question about the DPS protocols. It was out there for everybody. Defense counsel was aware of it. We didn't hide that from the jury. If he wanted to go into why those protocols are in place and what significance they have, the defense counsel should have objected and put the trial judge on notice. So I think it's not really fair to the trial judge to say he abused his discretion when we met our threshold reliability showing.
So are you saying his only really issue on appeal left would be challenge to the sufficiency of evidence?
Justice Livingston, I believe the relevance objection that he made is what's left. And a trace amount of cocaine is certainly going to be relevant for all the reasons that they're complaining of based on reliability. It does show some evidence of that there was non-metabolized cocaine in the blood at the time. But it would have been sufficient to convict based purely upon the 14 lines of cocaine, the 1.4 milligrams of cocaine that were metabolized out in the system, because the jury heard how fast cocaine metabolizes, that there's an hour and a half gap between when the wreck happens and when the blood was drawn, and that it continues to metabolize once it's the draw
Wasn't
happens.
Wasn't that speculation, though? Wasn't she talking about could have, or it's possible that it was, maybe I misunderstood the objection, but I thought part of the objection was her speculation about, and so it's possible that this could mean, and it's possible that she could have, or a person could have.
I believe you're correct in the sense that I asked her several hypotheticals where she used the trace amount as some evidence in the hypothetical. So, as experts do, she testified based on her training and her expertise in answering hypothetical questions about the significance of the non-metabolized cocaine. But I just want to be clear that it's not that the 1.4 milligrams of metabolite, the jury couldn't have considered that. She could have clearly easily been under the influence of that when she was driving this binge quantity of cocaine. I don't remember without looking. I think we went over even more in the gatekeeper than we did in front of the jury, because I try not to put the jury to sleep. But we did ask a lot of that at the gatekeeper. But I think when the judge says, he makes a finding that it's relevant and reliable at the gatekeeper, I think he's saying, everything I've been presented, this is a reliable process. It's a reliable methodology. The instrument is reliable that produced the data, this fingerprint that she testified off of. And so if defense counsel wants to get into a hyper-specific reliability objection at that point, and I think it's his burden to do that, notify the court and the parties so we could raise that evidence. And I think it's important to also consider the type of rule that appellant's asking the court to adopt, that basically in any case, in dealing with any type of scientific testimony, it doesn't matter what threshold reliability showing the state meets at the gatekeeper hearing, the Court of Appeals will do a de novo review and see if anything they want to complain about on appeal, they don't have to object to it. They can just, they can write for the first time on any issue, even though it should have been raised before the trial court. And I don't think that is a sensible rule, and I don't think it complies with the precedent of this court or the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure.
Good question. We hear civil cases as well, and we hear lots of gatekeeper cases in the civil cases. Is it the same standard for civil and criminal cases, the scientific gatekeeper questions and the scientific reliability and all? Do we look at civil cases as well as criminal cases in making this determination, or is it a separate standard for civil impugnment?
I don't want to get out in an area that I'm not familiar with. I've been a prosecutor most of my career. I would say that I know that the proponent of scientific evidence, I think whether it's civil or criminal, bears the burden of showing that meeting that initial reliability threshold. But for all the reasons that I've cited, I think the record shows we met that. But I think the case law is very clear that you've got to make specific and timely objections, as including 33.1 of the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure. And defense counsel failed to do that at the trial level. What he was telling the judge and the prosecutor is, I'm objecting to the relevance of this, and I'm citing a case that deals with extrapolation with Xanax and Valium where no expert was called. Well, here we have an expert who's on the stand who's testifying as to why all of the testimony was relevant, and his objection repeatedly is to the metabolite. He does make a relevance objection when she, at one point, about the trace amounts of cocaine, too. But I think the thrust of the gatekeeper hearing is he's saying they shouldn't be able to talk about the metabolite based on the Layton case, and that's what he's notifying the trial court of.
But the hearing was both on reliability and relevancy, so did he not request that hearing?
Justice Gardner, you're correct. He did request the hearing, and the judge did make a finding that it was both reliable and relevant. My point is that if you think of the Venn diagram, we have that burden of the initial burden of showing the reliability, you know, because I'm the proponent of the scientific evidence. I think we established that burden when we showed that the instrument that generated the data was reliable, that's accepted all across the United States, and that she is an expert trained in that data. Now, there's a whole host of reasons for why DPS protocols may have a cutoff. None of that was developed at the trial court because defense counsel never objected on those grounds. But I agree with you, the judge did make a determination that it was reliable and relevant.
Mr. Gillespie.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't know much about lines of cocaine. Whenever the testimony is that a line of cocaine, if it was inhaled, is 100 milligrams of cocaine. That would be 14 lines of cocaine. Now, is that a lot of cocaine? What's a line?
Well, I can get it kind of backdoor that. Her testimony was that it was consistent with a binge amount of cocaine.
Yes. Now, I want to also go back to what you were talking about on your hypothetical, because when you look at page 52 of the record, your hypothetical asks that I want you to assume these facts, which right above that is 1.4 milligrams of benzylethylamine, and that's the equivalent of 14 lines of 100 milligrams per line of cocaine. And then your hypothetical says, all right, and then you want to assume these facts, and similar to the previous hypothetical, a little bit different. There is a wreck that occurred at 5:33, blood draw an hour and a half later in the emergency room, and then the blood test that's performed revealed 1.4 milligrams of benzylethylamine and trace amounts of cocaine in the blood. Do you have an opinion as to whether at 5:33 p.m. when the accident occurred there was cocaine in that driver's bloodstream? Answer, since I saw cocaine in the sample at trace amounts, based on the short half-life of cocaine and the fact that it degrades in the blood too, even refrigerated storage, it may have been significantly higher at the time you mentioned. All right. But is it your testimony that there would have been cocaine in the driver's bloodstream at the time of driving? Yes, it is. Now, that's not speculative, and that's not guessing, and that's not saying possible. That's direct evidence testimony by the expert that there was cocaine in the spectrum dam system when the wreck occurred at 5:33 p.m.
That's correct, and I agree with Your Honor about that, she was able, because of the trace amount, to tie down the usage that it would have been higher at the time of driving. I think it's interesting, Justice Livingston mentioned this in one of her questions, even if you, when you touched on the quantifiable amount, even if you set aside the trace amount, what's the jury going to find out? But they're going to find out she had a binge quantity of cocaine, the equivalent of 14 lines, They're told that cocaine metabolizes very rapidly, that there's an hour and a half between the time of wreck and the time of the blood draw, and that it continues to break down in the blood vial. And all of this evidence of impaired judgment, impaired driving, hitting parked cars, jumping the curb, blowing through a major intersection at rush hour with a red light, I submit that even setting aside the trace amount of cocaine, it would have had that only had a slight impact on the verdict, that a massive binge quantity of metabolite that could have easily been active in her system, when the expert says you've got to look at any evidence of impairment, and then we have all of this evidence of impairment, that the trace amount, you know, while it was something important for the jury to hear, I think the ultimate effect on the verdict was slight because of all of the other evidence of the huge quantity of metabolite plus the driving facts.
Mr. Gillespie, what is the effect of the fact that the blood was drawn an hour and a half after the accident and that the first testing was not done until May? We don't have an exact date in the record, but it says May of 2008. So there would have been some continuing conversion from cocaine to metabolite from the time that the blood was drawn until it was tested in May of 2008.
That's correct, Justice Meyer.
And then in terms of the gas chromatograph mass spectrometer test, the GCMS, that wasn't done until on October the 8th of 2008. In other words, 8 months later. So there would still have been some decrease in the exact quantity of cocaine in the blood sample when it was tested months later.
That's correct, and all that testimony was brought out for the jury.
So the more reliable and the earlier test, that was the EMIT test, which was done in May, was at a more accurate sampling because of the chemistry effect that the cocaine continued to turn into metabolite in the months that it was being tested.
I definitely agree that the MIT was done closer in time to the time of driving, and you have that effect of the cocaine and the metabolite both continuing to break down. The testimony was it's not just the cocaine that breaks down in the blood, the metabolite does as well. When the defense expert, he didn't testify, but this my expert brought it out in her testimony, when he tested the cocaine even or the blood even later, there wasn't even any metabolite. All the metabolite had metabolized out. So the effect continues. And so I guess in summary, my 3 points. First off, we met our threshold showing of reliability by showing the instrument was reliable, the data that it produced was reliable, that the expert was qualified to perform the analysis. She's a DPS toxicologist. I make that point. She's familiar with the protocols. She's a DPS toxicologist. If you look at the full import of her testimony, she's very comfortable answering questions based upon the trace amount. Nowhere does she indicate that it ceases to exist because of the protocols that are in place. But I think that we met our threshold showing of reliability.
Well, she says she's not supposed to testify to it, though.
And I guess my point is not to focus on that one narrow line, but look at the entire totality of her testimony, where she's very comfortable testifying about the trace amounts and answering questions. She works for DPS, so she's going to know their protocols, and that it, I think, just like the Court of Criminal Appeals in Summers, that still acknowledges that the trace amounts below reportable levels still exist as data to be considered. That's how she was able to use that. But I think we met our threshold showing of reliability, and it was incumbent upon the defense that if they want to get into a hyper, if they're over here on the Venn diagram on reliability, they want to lodge that objection and notify the parties that they want to get into DPS protocols and why they exist, and then it's incumbent upon them to do that. He never once does that at the gatekeeper hearing, and it's so important to me that when she testifies to the comment that you're talking about, Justice Gardner, there's not a peep out of defense counsel. There's not even a relevancy objection there. He doesn't ask for it to be stricken. He doesn't ask for a hearing outside the presence of the jury. He does nothing.
You wouldn't want it stricken because you want it corrected if you want the error.
But well, the trial court already ruled on that. The trial court ruled at the gatekeeper hearing. I mean, that's all the purpose of having a gatekeeper hearing, right?
Well, Justice Walker, I still contend, thinking about the Venn diagrams, we have that threshold showing of reliability, which we met, and that's what the court ruled on at the gatekeeper. It wasn't just limited to the trace amounts, but you're correct. The trace amounts and the metabolite.
So why would there need to be an objection to the testimony about the trace amounts of cocaine?
Because when she makes the comment in front of the jury that Justice Gardner was talking about, I can't even say that I saw it. At that point, that's what's raised the questions about the DPS protocols. If he wants to lodge an objection about reliability, he needs to do that at that point in time so the court can take it up. Striking the testimony would be one thing the court would have, if that was necessary. We don't even know whether that would be necessary or not because no objection was made.
You don't have anything for appeal.
Well, I take that point. But there's also not an objection. My point is the defense counsel never hones in on that, never lodges any objection to that.
Well, I don't want to speak for Justice Walker, but I think what she's saying is if the objection is raised at the beginning and you ask for the hearing and the judge rules on reliability and rules on relativeness, that it's like a motion to suppress. You've done your objections and now you don't have to do it in front of the jury again. You're saying that because it didn't come up in the gatekeeper hearing and it came up for the first time full-blown in front of the jury?
Well, there are two points that I would address there. First off, Matt answered the question. I think that at the gatekeeper hearing, I mean, that's where the expert's on the stand. She's talking about trace amounts. If defense counsel has questions about that, she says it's below reportable levels. He doesn't ask hardly any questions about that at the gatekeeper. The judge asks what objections he has to her testimony. He never lodges an objection like that at the gatekeeper. So I think what Judge Weatherton had at the gatekeeper was that you have the gas chromatograph testing method that generated the data, including the trace amount of cocaine below reportable amounts, but that is a reliable scientific methodology, that she is a toxicologist who's trained in conducting the analysis and interpreting the results, so we meet that threshold showing of reliability. My point is that I think the case law talks about you have three distinct bases for objections, and if then I think it's her answer before the jury that kind of raises the question where she says, I can't even say that I saw it. At that point in time, if he wants to lodge a reliability objection, it's incumbent upon him to do that, to take some action, but he takes no action at all. And I would just say, you know, she's a trained toxicologist by DPS, and she testified that that's data that her instrument created and generated. Nothing was hidden from the jury about that, and it's the same type of evidence that the Court of Criminal Appeals looks at in Summers and says that it's some evidence, this trace amount beneath reportable levels is some evidence that the MIT test in Summers was not unreliable. So for all those reasons, I would ask you to affirm the judgment of the trial court.
I'm sorry, I have a question about what you just said. In Summers, I did not see that. They said if the trace amounts below the minimum levels required by the DPS protocol were some evidence.
It is in the Summers opinion. I have it in direct quotes in my preparation, but it's evidence. And then the quote was not indicative of a false positive on the EMIT test. They also refer to it as significant. The quote there is significantly, the record shows that the gas chromatograph test did in fact show traces of cocaine in Briggs' blood even after this passage of time, but at a level below the minimum required by DPS protocol to be reported as positive. This evidence suggests that the negative gas chromatograph test in this case does not reflect upon the scientific accuracy of the MIT test.
Okay.
So I think that's...
So they did not though hold that, am I correct, that the MIT test results were admissible. They only held that it met the first two requirements of Kelly.
Right. And they were saying that it met the first two requirements of Kelly. And I think my point is the one Justice Gabriel raised, that they do look to the trace amounts below reportable levels as some evidence that it was not unreliable. So they recognize the data still exists. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gillespie. Mr. Francis, rebuttal?
Well, state says that the trace amount is not important. They went to a lot of trouble to get it in and talk about it in front of the jury, so I suggest, based on the testimony, it was very important to the state, and they knew that. The methodology, the valid methodology, I would suggest, includes the limitations that are built into the protocols, that it's the gas test is reliable if used properly. And the only evidence we have of proper usage is that anything below that particular cutoff can't even be commented on, can't be recognized, can't be used, period. They want to change it, then let them do what they did in this other case that we're talking about, the more recent case, and get lots of evidence, explain why the protocol is there, why it's not important, and why anybody can just disregard it. I'm not sure what the DPS thinks about their toxicologists just ignoring the rules, but that's up to them.
I can think back to breath test machines, and they would run standard controlled tests after they did somebody's breath test, and it was supposed to come within a certain amount of what they knew that substance to be. But just because it didn't, I don't recall, and that was a DPS protocol, I don't recall any case ever saying that the results of that breath test were not admissible.
I don't have a particular case in mind. I'll be honest with you. I can't recall that I've looked at that or seen cases that deals with that particularly. I think that even this newer case that we're talking about, though, the fact that they had to go out of their way to justify ignoring the protocol, though, and to have all this evidence and all this usage and all these court opinions before they would say it's okay to ignore the protocol of having the gas confirmation test, I think it shows the Court of Criminal Appeals is very concerned about that. But you cannot simply say, this is how we do things, and based on how we do things, this is a valid scientific method of doing it. But by the way, we don't really pay attention to how we do things. We can just ignore it, even though there's a procedure in place, there's a limitation in place, and we're going to just ignore it and do what we want to do. I think if you're going to ignore it, you've got to at least prove up the scientific reliability of ignoring that protocol. And I think that that's not...
Is it your position that the DPS protocol is addressed at admissibility?
It's our position that if you're going to ignore the protocol, that you have to show scientific reliability even if you ignore the protocol.
Well, isn't it accurate that the DPS protocol deals with what's put in a written toxicology report, not what's testified about?
Not according to Ms. Hawkins. She said to the jury, I'm not even allowed to say that I saw it. Which
that's,
to me...
And that's what you're relying on in stating that this reporting of trace amounts is not consistent with DPS protocol?
I'm relying on every time she says that she looked at a trace amount that was below the reportable cutoff, and every time, the cumulative effect of her testimony. She admitted. She's not supposed to use it. I mean, it's just there. That she says, I can't use it. It's below our protocol cutoff amount.
So if she'd had, I'm just in the middle of a question and answer session. If she had had other scientific evidence, like papers, texts from experts or that she relied on other than the DPS protocol, then maybe it would have been okay.
It's possible if you look at this other New York case, where they did, in fact, justify a deviation from that particular protocol of using the gas test. But if you look at that, it's just a ton of information and evidence that they used to justify it. Three different expert witnesses, lots of cases where this test had been used. And even then, it's limited to the very narrow point they're talking about of the scientific reliability of the MIT test. That's all they're talking about. And so when you get into the comment that was made earlier about we also saw a trace amount, I consider that just dicta. That's not what they based their opinion on. They didn't say because there was trace amount. They said, here are all the reasons we're going to hold the EMIT test is a valid standalone test for metabolites, which is all they talked about. It's because of all the cases that it's been used, both within the judicial system and outside the judicial system. And it's been used for lots of other things too, all these papers that have been written as how it works in the testimony of the three expert witnesses as to how the EMIT test works. Take that all together and you can justify what they did. But the problem is, look at this case, there was absolutely no attempt to justify at all. And I would make one other quick point that what the state is trying to do is trying to shift the burden to the defendant. Their own case, Shaw versus State, they cite in their brief, says basically a specific objection needs to only say reliability, relevance, qualifications. And they make the distinction between qualifications and the others. But once that's raised, which it was in this case, if you look at it, the clerk's record pages 24 through 26, he talks about that and asks for a hearing. At the end of that document, the judge signs an order saying, I will have a hearing on relevance. But when the hearing starts, and that's on clerk's record page 40, the judge says at the beginning of the gatekeeper hearing that this hearing is to determine reliability of expert testimony. At that hearing, the witness talked about seeing traces in relying on traces and conclusions she made about traces. I called the attention of the court to pages 17 and 18 of volume 5 of the reporter's record. Then after the hearing, the court specifically found the expert evidence to be relevant and reliable. Said that. And now the state's saying, well, but you know, if something came out, you got to make a very specific objection. Well, under that case, simply saying relevance, reliability is a specific objection. You don't have to go any further than that. The burden shifts to the trial judge, well, the state to prove it, but the trial judge makes the ruling. He listens to it and says, am I satisfied? It's not the defendant's burden.
Is that now, Ms. Francis?
Oh, okay, I just want to make that point.
Statement?
Thank you.
All right, we appreciate all your arguments today and all of your briefings. Mr. Souter, we appreciate you being here as well. We thank you. Your case is now submitted, and we will now adjourn court.
All rise.